Welcome to Tech Talks. Every September, school staff are told about new teaching techniques, but don't always hear about why they should work. If we're going to implement techniques in classrooms, we need to know why they work and how our students can get the most out of them. For those of you who don't know who TEPS are, we are trainee educational psychologists from the University of Southampton, and today we're here to talk about two contradicting theories of learning. On the one hand, we have cognitive load theory, which on the surface suggests that we should be making learning easier for students. And on the other hand, we have desirable difficulties theory, which, as the name suggests, means making learning experiences more difficult. So, Alex and Lawrence, would you like to tell us a little bit more about cognitive load theory?
Yes, thank you, Christian. Cognitive load theory can be defined as the effort that working memory resources require to perform a task. A psychologist called Suella refers to three types of cognitive load: intrinsic load, which is the unavoidable processing required to carry out the task; extraneous load, which is the more unnecessary processing not related to the task; and germane load, which is the deep processing of the material needed to form new connections and develop understanding.
So what does this mean for teachers?
So the theory suggests that what teachers should be trying to do is to help children reduce their cognitive load by removing extraneous factors. Sweller found that in a study when pictures were provided alongside text for children that were learning to read, this actually interfered with their learning and resulted in more errors due to the increased cognitive load that was caused by having to divide their attention between the text and the picture. Sweller then went on to describe the implications of cognitive load in problem solving, suggesting that problem solving is unproductive as a learning method due to the heavy cognitive load that the process requires. If students spend more time processing information about how to solve the problem itself, this leaves little capacity in working memory for developing schemas, which commit the learning to long-term memory. Therefore, the students successfully problem solve, but they actually learn little from the experience.
So, what does this look like in lessons?
Well, Sweller stressed the benefits of explicit instruction and worked examples. If teachers work through the problem for the student, then the student can concentrate on the content and learn more effectively instead of wasting working memory resources on searching for a solution.
Has there been any research on this at all?
There has been lots of research into the value of instructional approaches. For example, in 2009, Sweller and Cooper found that when participants were given worked examples for algebraic equations, they took considerably less time to process this than a conventional problem. And even further to this, when given future problems that were similar to this original, they could actually solve them more rapidly.
Can you tell me about any drawbacks from this?
Yeah, there are some exceptions. There's much less research into the effectiveness of cognitive load theory for teaching in more creative subjects like art. This brings into question whether problem solving should be disregarded in teaching methods or whether it can actually be useful in certain contexts.
Should teachers always be using worked examples?
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because one theme that cognitive load theory acknowledges is the expertise reversal effect, which suggests that the overuse of worked examples can actually become counterproductive as learners develop more expertise. Whilst cognitive load theory states that explicit instructions is better for novice learners, it also recognises the gradual introduction of increasingly independent problem-solving tasks as learners gain experience. Renkel referred to this as the guidance fading effect, which implicates that teachers can gradually fade assistance to students as they gain a knowledge of the process.
We've heard how the use of worked examples can reduce cognitive load and improve learning, but is there some value in making learning challenging? Husna, what does psychology say about this?
So in the 90s, Bjork came up with the desirable difficulties theory to describe learning tasks which appear to be difficult and might slow down learning initially, but actually produce better results long term. It's important to note that for tasks to be desirable, they must also be attainable. At first, learning with desirable difficulties may take longer and the student may not feel as confident, but over time, knowledge will be retained better.
So this contrasts quite strongly with cognitive load theory, right?
Yes, this theory suggests that making things more difficult to retrieve improves long-term retention of content and transfer.
What does this look like in the classroom?
There are four main ways of implementing these in student learning, whether that's teacher-led or independent. The first is by varying conditions of learning. This could be, for example, by changing the room you're learning in or varying the conditions of practice. Kerr and Booth did a study and found that children who practiced throwing a beanbag from various distances outperformed children who threw from the same fixed distance, even though the test conditions were at the fixed distance.
So the challenge for the practice task is what made them more skilled in the test condition.
Yes, exactly.
That's interesting. So how else would we introduce challenge?
The second idea is by spacing learning over time, and this is far more effective than the cramming many students practice. Spacing involves revisiting content at spaced intervals and works by encouraging students to retrieve information they may have learned a week or more ago. By increasing the length of intervals between sessions, the effort required to retrieve the content increases, thus enhancing learning. Whilst this may not be the most efficient use of time on its own, it can be combined with a third technique, which is interleaving. Essentially, this is learning in a sequence pattern, for example, literacy followed by numeracy followed by science. These should be repeated randomly for optimal learning.
Yeah, we can see this in schools because teachers do tell students to revise in topic blocks, but for some reason, they still rely on cramming.
One thing teachers don't often use is a final technique, which is called generating or testing. By testing, we don't mean the formative assessments which occur at different points of the year. Bjork and Bjork say that unfortunately, tests are often seen as a means of assessment rather than a mode of learning. But low-stakes testing is better for learning than children sitting through a presentation. Dunlosky and colleagues found that testing in this manner works across the age range, from kindergarten to middle-aged learners, and also across subjects. They also found that results were better even when final tests were up to a year or more later. What's great about testing is that it's easy to implement in classrooms or at home via the use of technology such as Kahoot, Socrative, and many more, which allow students to anonymously or otherwise answer questions.
So this is different to what we were talking about in terms of reducing students' cognitive load and the effort that they have to make in solving problems?
Yeah, desirable difficulties do require more effort and they do force students to do more complex processing. They may make more mistakes as they do this and feel as if they've forgotten things. But this forgetting is actually key to learning, as retrieval efforts, more than restudying, enhance retention in future and different contexts. It is important to remember that children do need background knowledge or skills for these techniques to work effectively. Although the techniques we've discussed may seem difficult and hard to implement, they are beneficial. By making things difficult but achievable, we all make errors and this is what makes us learn.
So there's a connection between cognitive load and desirable difficulties.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
It seems to be less of a conflict between two theories and actually they lie more on a continuum.
Yeah, it seems so. It seems to be that each theory has its place in different contexts and dependent on the level of expertise of the learner.
Oh, so in sum, both theories appear to have equal benefit for teachers to support learning in schools. We could reduce cognitive load for learners who are at the beginning of their journey, and as they begin to grasp the concept and gain more expertise, we can increase the level of desirable difficulties to facilitate further learning. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for our next podcast.
Goodbye.